Our high school guidance counselor used to ask us what you would do if you had $1 million, didn't have to work. And then invariably, whatever you'd say, that was supposed to be your career. So if you wanted to fix old cars, then you're supposed to be an auto mechanic.
So what did you say?
I never had an answer. I guess that's why I'm working at Inatech.
No, you're working at Inatech because that question is bullshit to begin with. If everyone listened to her, there'd be no janitors because no one would clean up if they had $1 million.
If I had $1 million. If I had $1 million.
I'm talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world and I am a material girl. Or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Well, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke, don't do
If I had $1 million. If I had $1 million.
Warren Orpex, Jackson Jackson, I'm Tamal. Andrew on the board on a Wednesday. S&P futures down 4 and NASDAQ futures down 13. Slight pullback here. Yesterday was a mixed day after three huge days in a row. So it wasn't much of a pullback, maybe just a rest. Do we have Mr. O'Neill?
Good morning.
How are you?
I too need a rest.
From what?
My grueling lifestyle.
Yeah, I was just thinking about
my
that.
Grueling old man lifestyle.
Well, you know, for an old guy, you get around pretty good.
I do get around pretty good.
Just saying, you know. Yeah, interesting. I felt like once in a while, you know, I mentioned that when you have a farm situation, and one of the ways that you can hedge your, say, for instance, you have a corn crop, a soybean crop, whatever it happens to be, those are the two biggest ones here in Illinois, that you have to be careful that if you plant your crops, and you, I'll use some numbers, and it costs you $250 to get them in the ground, you know that number, and all of a sudden the futures are trading $4, so you're happy with a dollar and a half. You can hedge your crop by selling the futures at $4, and then basically lock in, or an attempt to lock in, a dollar and a half profit. Now the idea being, if the futures price and the spot price, which will equal at some point, go up to $6, you've lost $2 on your future, but now you've picked up $2 on your spot corn, meaning your physical corn, so you're essentially even on the transaction. You've locked in your dollar and a half, but you're also pissed off that you didn't hang on and just get the $6. And it could work the other way as well. So I've said once in a while that sometimes you have to be careful to do that. You do that with your whole crop, because what if something crazy happens to your place? You know, like a local flood or a hailstorm, like on your farm. So sometimes you might, instead of doing hedging all the crop, guys might do half, they might do a third. They might buy some puts to lock in the lower price a little bit, pay for some insurance that way. And most people have crop insurance, which I don't know that much about, but I know that it's offered by the Department of Agriculture, and I think most people have it. I got a huge example of that yesterday, Kevin.
Okay.
Now you're gonna ask me how could that even be, Chief? How could that even be? Well, on Sunday, Audrey drags me. Of course, this is all for my benefit, right? We're going to go down to this place way the hell down in Linwood, a big flower place. Audrey and her friend Kathy are really into, you know, making their yards look nice and the flowers and all that stuff. Well, I like to plant a couple of, you know, tomato plants, and she likes having her herbs out there, and she does the basil and the rosemary and all that stuff. So anyway, we go down to this place.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. So we go down to this place, and we buy all this stuff. You know, not that much. I buy like 5 tomato plants and a couple of peppers and all the different herbs you can use for, you know, your pasta sauce and everything. So we put it on the bench where we're going to put the pots come this weekend and transplant everything over. So all of a sudden she calls yesterday. Listen to this. It sounded like Armageddon. The hailstorm down there was unreal in Orland. I guess it made it all the way from like Plainfield to Midway or something. And it was just pounding down the place. Her whole deck looked like it was wintertime. It looked like a snowstorm. And near the house where it was all coming off the roof, it was about knee high. And it took like a couple hours from the melt. Needless to say, our plants are toast. So it wasn't my livelihood.
Where are you going this weekend?
I think we're going back to the place in Lynnwood. Just a thought. I have a feeling. Plus, it's way the hell down there. I mean, so I don't know. I don't think we have to go that far to buy a tomato plant, but according to Audrey, these are the world's best plants, right? So I ended up with a Better Boy, a Big Boy, a beefsteak, and a cherry, and something else. So now who knows what I'll get this time.
So are they all dead? Or
she thinks a few...
100% wipeout, or...
Well, she says the basil's shredded. Rosemary seems to have withstood the attack. So we probably don't have to do everything. She says a couple of tomato plants look worse than the others, but the little tiny ones are probably all right. The bigger ones are probably shot. But it was big enough to... I have a feeling if your car was out, you've got some problems. It was that big. So the guy next door came running out, and the hail was bonking off his head to put his car in the garage. Not so sure that was a good trade-off, but... Anyway, he did it.
You need a helmet for that, don't you?
Oh, no kidding. Well, unbeknownst to, why would anybody know this? Other than, like, the hurricanes, which have been recent, when I say recent, there's always been hurricanes, but the huge damage hurricanes we've had, before that, the biggest insurance nightmares have always been hailstorms, where they've had to, fix, like, 200,000 cars or something in Orlando. Lou says it happens all the time in Denver. People are getting their cars fixed or they're totaling them or something. You get a hail damage title on your car where the insurance company takes it over and buys it from the... And then you can buy one. You can buy it. And it's not like it's flood damage or anything, but it doesn't look so good. You can buy one. And the title will say hail damage or whatever. If you really wanted one that doesn't look too bad and runs fine, you probably could go get one of those cheap. Just saying.
I'll keep it in mind. I'll shop in Denver next time.
Well, you gotta follow the hail, Follow the hail.
What the hail?
Yeah, what the hail? I did hear a story last night in doing research for Stacks and Jacks about some player here from Chicago, a school will go nameless, where he was recruited to a school, and apparently the kid's supposed to be a kind of a freak lineman. Recruited to a school that we know, not Notre Dame, and the school in Florida said we got to have this guy, and seriously paid up evidently. So there's big bidding wars on some of these high school kids.
Yeah, it's like professional sports free agency without the restrictions that you have for without salary caps, without terms to the contracts. Or anything like that. It's just a different world.
Well, when is it, from my economic background, I'm going to say, my behavioral economic background, I'm going to say, when is it going to break? And when I say break, when are the schools that are all in on this? And I'll bet there's maybe 40, maybe 32. That essentially want to have a college-sponsored professional team. Going to break from the rest of the guys and go, nah, this is just people that come to school here, have teams, go play each other, blah, blah, blah. I mean, it has to break because everybody's not into this.
I've been telling you that for a while now. That's exactly what's going to happen is they're going to split off from the rest of the NCAA, and then they're going to start making them employees. So they can put them under contract terms. The coaches, many of them benefit from the status quo, but that doesn't mean they like the status quo because there's so much uncertainty. Used to be you had to recruit high school players. Now the first thing you have to do when the season's over is re-recruit your existing roster. Then you have to go start, figure out who leaves and what gaps you have. And so then you got to start recruiting transfers. And then maybe, just maybe, you can get back to the high school players, except for the handful of schools who are already dabbling in the model of saying, well, forget the high school players. We'll maybe recruit four or five of those every year, but we don't, but why should I bother? They're just going to leave me anyway.
When is, where's Lou when we need him? When is somebody going to break from the standard contract? Because doesn't every...
What do you mean break from the standard contract?
I have a feeling, I don't know this for sure, but so I'm asking you. I have a feeling that just like a Major League Baseball contract where you sign up damn near for life, that it's a standard contract you sign. whether you're going to Notre Dame or Miami, Ohio or Indiana or wherever the hell you're going. I have a feeling that your scholarship, whatever you sign with the school, your commitment.
Oh, the letter of intent and the scholarship contract agreement.
Yeah, I bet they're equivalent.
Oh, there is a standard letter of intent. Yeah.
But I'm saying if I grab some kid from my alma mater Marist, and he's on a scale of 1 to 5 is the recruit guys. He's a big kid, very coordinated. Maybe could use some weight. Isn't filled out quite yet. You know, blah blah blah. Whatever it is. Has what you think to be really big potential. Notre Dame doesn't want him. Michigan doesn't want him. So Miami of Ohio says, I'll take him. Well, it costs to recruit him, and you're going to be here, and you hope the kid's going to... You see potential for this kid being like an All-American. He's, you know, one of those kind of guys. You're going to say, if you leave after 2 years, I want money back. I mean, if you don't even play here, you play here a few games, and all of a sudden you fill out, and now you're a star, and you're going somewhere else. We want some dough, either from you or the school you're going to. But you have a contract with us for 4 years.
Yeah. So if you sign not whether it's a 4-year contract, a 3-year, or a 2-year, it doesn't matter. But if you decide to break the contract early, it'll be just like every other contract. Your terms of separation are going to be specified in the contract. If they are not, if you don't, like every contract that I did in my IT days was it had. What are the terms for breach? What are the terms for end of contract? Require a certain amount of notice lest it auto renew, and then what are the terms for convenience? And I would also try to get, because I was in the banking world and there were lots of acquisitions, I would try to get special terms based on if the bank was acquired. Which several of mine were. Once you're acquired, I would try to get terms that said, that the buyout was much more attractive than it would be. And most of the service types of companies would be looking for something like 65% of the remaining, which I was never going to give anybody because that was too much. But if I sign a 5-year deal for services, and I want to leave you after 2 because I get a better deal somewhere else, what's my buyout terms? And that's kind of normal business, and I expect you're going to find that in some of the contracts that the players sign. Now, what'll be interesting about that is that a lot of these colleges are really crappy at this, and it shows up in their coaches' contracts.
Well, yeah, but just to give it a little...
Some of these coaches' contracts have no term. So, what if we terminate for cause? What if I have to fire somebody or fire a player for cause? That you can bet that's going to be spelled out. So the player that goes and gets arrested a lot or something like that, you can bet your booty that there's going to be something in the standard NCAA contract that deals with that.
Well, Kevin, we've been hacking around with this for a long time. I mean, since we were in school, and it seems like there's been for those that don't know, I think when we were young, it was considered by just about everybody a 4-year commitment on both sides. Now, whether I don't have a copy of a contract from 1975, but I think it was considered. Then it was a renewable, and some coaches kind of took advantage of that because the deal was, I think, Kevin, when we were in school, you could, I think you could recruit 30 a year, but you could only have 100 total on scholarship, which is a little weird on the math to start with. You would think it'd be 30 times 4, but it wasn't.
No, it was a maximum in any year, but also a maximum number of players on the team.
And in some schools...
That made sense to me. That made
okay,
sense
but I'm saying, but some schools took it to the next level. And the two we would consider, I wouldn't use the term cheating, although I already did, people had said, well, in order to make this math work, I want to recruit 30 people every year, all right? And so If I do that, that's 120. So I have to get 20 people that don't grow, don't get faster, maybe are marginally injured or something. I got to get 20 people to leave. Now, your schools, I think, that played it pretty straight, where Notre Dame, Michigan had a reputation of was a four-year commitment. Stanford surely did. I'm going to say Boston College did. But there's probably all kinds of other ones that I can't name. But because it actually became a series of four one-year commitments, right? But the school never really wanted the reputation of recruiting somebody. The guy just wasn't as good as they thought or didn't grow over the summer after his senior year, where they just said, okay, sophomore year, you don't have a ride anymore. So the schools that played it straight really were kind of at a disadvantage, because maybe some of the good guys left and sat out a year, but the other guys you were stuck with for 4 years. And we know guys, remember Stan, who played baseball his last 2 years, and he didn't make it a quarterback, and there were all kinds of guys like that. But the schools that had the reputation of, and Bear Bryant might have been one of these guys, but the guys that really had the reputation of it were the goofball at Nebraska and the guy at Texas. Darryl Royal at Texas. It wasn't Darryl Royal. Darryl Royal. And then what was the guy? Was it Bob Devaney, Nebraska? Mm-hmm. Where they would get all these kids, they made sure they had the full 30 that they thought would kind of grow. And they mostly were kids from Nebraska. And all of a sudden, if they didn't want you, it was, you know, on your hands and knees, push the football with your nose 100 yards every day and try to do everything they possibly could to get you to quit. Because they couldn't just off you, but
it was called running them off, and they would definitely run them off. They they sit them down and say, you know, you can stay if you want to, but you're not going to play, and we're gonna your life's going to be miserable because you're going to be fodder for the.
Well, they also discovered that if you're talking about some kids, a lot of kids are late developers. I mean, I was. I mean, I didn't get. To whatever level I got good in sports, I didn't get there until I was 22, 23.
Still developing, Tom.
I'm still developing something. But I was way better at everything at 22, 23 than I was at 18, which other people are not. You know, they mature quicker physically, whatever. You know, they have a beard when they're 12, you know, that kind of thing. I wasn't one of those kids. But so Bob Devaney said, we want everybody here for 5 years, remember? So now you're.
Yeah, he'd recruit his linemen like that and run his linemen through that program, and then he'd recruit his star athlete players from the East.
Yeah. So he would have a lot of his team was a lot of guys were 21, 22 playing against 18 year olds, which, you know, unless you got a really good 18 year old, normally the guy who's 21, 22, that's a big difference in male development those 4 years, wouldn't you say?
Yes.
So there were always those kinds of guys. Well, now I have a feeling that this contract is going to become, every school is going to have a different one, okay, and that's going to be one of the first iterations.
Well, the term of the contract is going to be part of the recruiting process.
Right. But this is just, I'm going to say it's going to happen. Economically, it's going to happen. You can leave after your third year. If you leave before that, either the team has to buy the contract or you owe us, you know, 75 grand back or something. And most kids are, how are you going to get the money back? Well, if you're getting paid, I guess you can save it, but I don't know how many people.
Here's the question. Will you be able to do like they do in real professional sports and make trades?
That's probably, once there's a contract involved, I don't see why you wouldn't.
Can you reassign the contract? Where that's going to come into play is there will be the players. First of all, the players won't be unionized when they start, but they're going to figure out pretty quickly that the game is going to be rigged back in favor of the schools like it used to be. Maybe not in the same ways that it used to be, but it is going to favor the colleges, and as a result, they're going to unionize.
Well, and I think
we'll probably spend at least one season without college football.
Well, and you're going to end up with, and this is the attitude, you know, we get. I mean, my reunion this year is at Notre Dame, and of course, my class is giddy to not almost orgasmic that the football coach is going to talk at our dinner on Friday night. Well, I'm not going to be there at the dinner on Friday night, so I could care less what the guy says, really. But he seems like a decent enough sort, so it's not like I don't care. But I mean, at some point. Guys, most, and I'm not just saying guys, a lot of the ladies are really into this too. you, somehow or another, whether your college team wins, your manhood doesn't grow an inch. I mean, at some point, UCLA, with an $11 billion budget, is going to say, I'm not going to sit here at this board meeting month after month worrying about our professional football team we're sponsoring. Get rid of it. We don't need it. I think schools are going to do that, Kevin. I can almost list them where I think they're coming from. I bet Boston College piles out. I'll bet Notre Dame, maybe. Some of the Big Ten schools, I don't think Purdue wants 25 people working the football portal lines and bidding for people and acting like they're the Bears. I don't think they have the stomach for that. I mean,
keep in mind you're thinking football at the moment, but keep in mind that basketball will be part of the equation.
Well, that's okay too. I mean, I'm saying
Purdue basketball is a different sensibility than Purdue football is.
Well, I mean,
same thing at Indiana, by the way.
Yeah, I get it, but it's not like not that people don't love their teams, but at some level. I mean, I talked to one of the guys I used to do business with, Dirk Mueller from Germany. I said, one day we're having a beer, and I said, Dirk, what's the story in Germany with soccer teams? Do the athletic teams, do the colleges, you know, have soccer teams? He goes, what is the connection between college and soccer? There is none. He goes, they may have a club team. Well, you want to play soccer, you play soccer. You want to go to school, you go to school. If you want to do both, that's fine.
The legacy of this was, hey, let's get up a game against against the schools up the road.
Yeah.
And that goes back, you know, more than 100 years. So that's where it, you know, that's the roots of it, but it has obviously morphed into something completely different. I think if you look, you might be able to look at many of the other sports that are played, and they have more of that original intent flavor to them. Baseball, softball, lacrosse even to an extent, although lacrosse is pretty big time amongst the lacrosse schools. But if you were to go to a Notre Dame lacrosse game, for example, it's only, you know, it's not very expensive to get in, if anything. They have, you know, one side is of the field is the stands, the other side is a berm. It's a big picnic, you know, on the other side where people go to hang out and enjoy the game, but also, they'll be there with their. I don't think they allow alcoholic beverages over there, but otherwise, you know, people are over there with their sandwiches or whatever.
You have your gummies.
Yeah, you could have your gummies. In Indiana, that's still not legal.
It's
a short drive to Michigan. That's right. So you have all of that going on, and that's sort of that, you know, has that almost extracurricular activity, or, you know, let's go cheer for our classmates type of feel to it. And that's a little bit different. It's really primarily football and basketball. To a lesser extent, baseball at some schools, at a handful of schools. But even then, you know, if you were to go to a baseball game at, say, Arkansas or someplace like that where it's a significant sport, it's still everybody is gathering on the, you know, out in the outfield more so than they are sitting in the stands worrying about the game, and it's a whole event. I think that's, you know, that's what... You know, if you were to say what was college sports intended to be, that's it. It's just that it's not that when it comes to football.
Well, and also, I'm sure we got to catch the break here.
And maybe a few others. You know, depending on the school, it's going to depend on which other ones.
But there are people, Kevin, and I'm sure in 3 weeks I'm going to run to a bunch of them, my friends, my old friends, that are absolutely convinced that if you don't have football, you lose all your contributions. And nothing could be further from the truth. You look at the schools that have the biggest endowments, none of them really play football. I mean, a couple of them do, but not very many. The idea that somehow UCLA, with an $11 billion budget, would lose their contributions from alumni if they didn't play football is so ludicrous, I can't even go there.
Well, Notre Dame's model for that was, if you want to get in the football ticket lottery, you have to contribute X number of dollars, and that sort of depended on, you know, what year of graduation you were and so on. But so, you know, they tied getting football tickets to that.
Well, they also would, I mean,
that's not working for them anymore because they don't sell out anymore for a number of reasons, partly stadium expansion, but also partly just the way they've constructed the schedule and the night games and all kinds of things that are inhibitors to people actually going to games. Now that they have that, they don't sell out. So you don't need to make a contribution to get tickets. You just have to wait for the sale to the general public.
Well, I have my mother's cousin, so I guess it would be my second cousin, married into some scratcho. They're in the RV business, very successful, and somehow or another they got in. They actually did, out of all things, Kevin, they did signal lights for canals or something. Evidently, there are signal lights for canals, and they were in that business, and they sold it, and they got into the the wire you put down where it's light optic, not copper,
fiber optic.
So right in the dot bomb era, they started doing fiber optics, an area which was doing a lot of cable and all that stuff, and they ended up getting essentially a dot bomb price for the fiber optic company. They got all this dope. Well, anyway, they ended up giving a building to Ohio State, like 35 mil back when you can build a building for that. And now they have, the number one RV parking spot, and they've got a skybox and like four extra tickets. But some of our guys will say the only reason why they gave them the 35 million was to get that stuff. I'm going to say that schools use it as a kind of reward. I don't think anybody would give you $35 million just to get a skybox. I mean, your motivation would have to be somewhat different. Everybody's
rather pricey suite.
I mean, there's no question if you and I decided all of a sudden Stocks and Jacks became, some huge thing and we gave the Irish $5 million, I guarantee you we'd have really good seats for every game, maybe even a skybox spot. But I don't think we would be dumb enough to give them $5 million just for some football seats, would we? We'd have to have another motivation.
I might give it to them if they had reclining chairs in the suite.
What about if we had free beers?
Otherwise, I don't go anyway.
I would say
come home and watch it in the recliner.
At that point, I wouldn't use the term free. I'd say included beers. S&P futures down 9, NASDAQ futures down 40. We're leaking a little bit here. We've been up so much, I think a little leak might be sort of expected, and who knows, might still come right back. Be right back, Stocks and Jacks.
Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. I think most of you know that I'm also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients, and you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some maybe embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years I've seen a relatively one-way market. It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are, what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310.
Is your business being challenged by the complexities surrounding healthcare reform or other matters related to human resources management? If so, then Cognos HR can help. A longtime friend and contributor to the Stocks and Jocks radio program, Cognos HR provides its clients with a perfect blend of strategic consulting and day-to-day HR management to drive overall improvement in business performance. Companies that join the Cognos HR family are better able to manage healthcare costs, enhance benefit offerings, and improve employee satisfaction by leveraging our access to Fortune 500 benefits. Our innovative onboarding and payroll technology, along with our constant attention to detail, enables us to provide the highest level of quality service to our clients. Now, your time and energy can be focused on generating business and increasing your bottom line. We'll take care of the rest. For more information, call us at 630-401-8810 or search us on the web at CognosHR.com. Cognos HR, innovation in human resources, licensed in Illinois and Arizona.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Low and no pick, Stacks and Jacks. I'm Tom Howie, Andrew on the board. SP Futures down 10, NASDAQ Futures down 45. Again, we're leaking a tad here. We got the Dow down 24 as well. In ways of individual stocks in the Dow, I see nothing moving really huge at all in the Dow. And the seven big stacks everybody cares about. Got NVIDIA down $3 and Tesla down 266, but not really a whole lot of movement there either. Yesterday, the big mover was Disney, just got clobbered, and it never really came back. And down another 29 cents today. I mean, had like a 12% move. That's a big move in a stock like that. I mean, one that's been around as long as those guys. DAX up 71.4%, FTSE up 26.3%, CAC around up 73.9%. So, more earnings reports over there. Europe's been pretty frothy. Over in Asia, Nikkei down 632, 1.6%. That's the first time it's been down for a while. Hang Seng down 165.9%, Shanghai down 19.6%. Earnings over there, and the Nikkei is kind of leading the bus down there. Yesterday, mixed bag. Dow up 31, S&P up 6, Nasdaq down 17. So very, very boring. They would call that from on the floor an inside day. 10-year rate up 3 basis points, 4.49. The Bund up 4, 2.46. Japan up 2.89. Oil down another 97 cents, 77.41. So oil is not heading, at least right now, to $100. And whatever the Saudis tried the other day didn't work. Brent up down 98 cents, 82.17. Natural gas up 5 cents, 2.26. RBOB down 4 cents, 2.49. It's a big move on RBOB. It's almost 2%. Gold down 90 cents, 23.23. Silver down 7 cents, 27.46. Copper down 7 cents, 4.53. So quiet to down in the metals markets. Foreign exchange, the euro is still at 107.4. And the pound at 124.8, so nothing much going on there. And last but not least, crypto down 757, the Bitcoin, but at over 1%, 62,345. Andrew, what do you got for us? Trevi Weather Sports.
All right, it is 6:40 here in Chicago, Wednesday, May 8th. Starting off with just a little bit of sports, some baseball from yesterday. The Diamondbacks won over the Reds, 6-2. White Sox lost to the Rays, 1-5. And the Cubs won over the Padres 2-3. Over to Chicago weather, it is currently 56 degrees. We're going to have sunny skies today. We're going to have a high of 72 degrees, but we're probably going to have some showers into the night. Over in Phoenix, they are currently at 66 degrees. They got clear skies as well. They're going to have a high of 89 degrees, and that's going to hit around 5 p.m. Now, finally, for Chicago traffic, inbound traffic is looking pretty heavy from nearly every major expressway. We have two different accidents on the inbound Kennedy. One of them is right before Keeler Avenue, and the other one is right before Fullerton Avenue. And as well, it looks like a closure on the outbound, Eisenhower, due to a rollover accident. And that is blocking all lanes, and that is between, looks like, Harlem Avenue and Des Plaines Avenue. So things aren't looking amazing out there today, but if you're coming in from the south side, it's going to be a little bit better. So that's all I got. Back to you, Chief.
So how do you get from the north side to the south side and come in that way? You can't.
Not today. Not
no,
in this
not
case.
No, not today. I'd turn back if I were you.
Yep.
Although it worked out for us. We got on at North Avenue, or Division, and there was nobody because they were all blocked at Fullerton. So, you know, one man's, what did Fred Sanford used to say? One man's treasure is another man's junk. I don't think you remember Fred Sanford, Andrew.
Yeah.
No, he doesn't.
I don't want to know about another man's junk.
Oh, God, me neither. Hey, Kevin,
hey, before you go, 35 years ago today, Michael Jordan made Craig Eagle's career memorable.
Yeah. It doesn't seem like that long ago, does it?
It doesn't.
No, it sure doesn't.
It doesn't. We can't be that old, can we?
No. When did he get, when was Jordan drafted? Late 80s, right?
It was like 83-ish.
Yeah. Wow.
So, no, I think it was earlier than that. It wasn't late 80s, it was earlier 80s.
I remember the guys who were on the team before that, and they had a really strong group that didn't win anything, although they got robbed 1 year when they played Portland with Sloan and Chet Walker and those guys.
The Portland one was Artis Gilmore too.
Yeah, and then they had a
that wasn't I was it Sloan? I know Norm Van Leer was still on that team. I'm not sure. I'm not sure who all was left from the.
Well, Bob Love was, I think.
Yeah, I don't know. That's pretty easy to find out while we talk though.
But anyway, then they had a group in the middle that they had some guys that had some drug issues and all kinds of stuff, and it was kind of a weird team. And when Jordan got there, I mean, he kind of, you know, he wasn't into any of that stuff. Well, he liked to play poker and gamble, but he wasn't a drinker and he didn't do any drugs. So he was kind of with the changes in coaching, I mean, the whole focus, not just was he that good, the whole focus kind of changed. But hey, how good is this Minnesota team? They're giving Denver all they mean. Are they going to sweep Denver? Denver's probably got the best player in basketball on their team, and they are the reigning champs.
Hey, it's hard to win 2 years in a row, and yes, Minnesota's very good.
Where do they get these guys? I mean, I don't watch them, so I mean, it looks like they got a couple of really big, huge guys in the middle that are awful good.
Well, Carl Anthony Towns, don't you remember him?
Yep.
From Kentucky?
Yep.
But Minnesota's got. Let's pull up their roster and just take a peek.
And the Knicks sure look better than I thought with that guy from Dallas. He's all world. The guy from here in Illinois.
The Knicks are interesting because they have three guys who were teammates on a national championship team at Villanova.
Well, they went and got the other guy this year, right? The guy he was Dallas for 3 years. Brunson, the guy from Illinois, Stevenson. He was.
I think they've had Brunson a little longer. I may be wrong about that.
I think they just got him this year, because he did 3 years in the Mavericks, and he was okay there, but he wasn't like he is this year.
No, he's been good for a while.
I mean, it's a breakout year. I mean, in terms of his stats, I don't think they ever used him quite right on Dallas or whatever. But Thibodeau's getting a lot out of him. Thibodeau's a good coach, you know. I mean,
yeah, he actually, this is his second year with the Knicks. He was with Dallas before that, and when he was with Dallas, his last couple of years, you know, he started out 9 points a game, then 8 points a game, then went to 12, then went to 16. So he was a steady improver. You got to remember, he was not a high draft pick. In fact, he was a second round draft pick. And second round draft picks often don't make rosters in the NBA. So, you know, when you're taken second, you're not likely to be just walk into a key role. It takes a couple of years.
Well, for those that don't know, the NBA only has two rounds, right?
Right.
Kevin, all this the stuff we've been talking a lot about sports here, but the stuff we've been talking about this week with Mike and John and everybody regarding, you know, some of the thing Lou sent about our miscues and his foreign policy, and there always seems to be a buzzword through every one of these. For those who don't know, we tweeted out the other day. It was an article written by some guy who was ahead of Blackwater, so you got to take it with sort of a grain of salt. But he basically ran through the whole history of all these different countries going back to, you know, Reagan, for God's sake, and mistakes people made, and how even Reagan, with his famous, we're going to outspend the Russians and bury them, which did happen. The simple fact is, the group he was with, the neocons and people, wouldn't, and by the way, everybody knows I'm on record 100 times, I don't want my taxes going up, but they never matched up the resources and the taxes from his buddies to pay for what they were doing. So really, the on the credit card stuff started, you know, well, actually probably started with Vietnam, but and Reagan was no, you know, budget hawk on this stuff. He lowered taxes, and then he had to raise them again a couple of years later. He, you know, and this kind of went on, and now we don't pay for this. But one of the themes through there seems to be, Kevin, and it's, you know, more like a thread than a theme, is we seem to be more concerned in places where there's value, whether it be cocoa, whether it be oil, whether it be, now it's rare metals, you know, whatever it happens to be. And so our policy seems to be a little jaded by cash, go figure, right? And also, we seem to have a tough time figuring out which crazy dictators to leave in power, because they ended up being a lot better than what came after. Libya being an example, obviously Iraq being an example. And I don't know, I'm not sure how you judge that stuff. Those are tough calls. The questions in there, his conclusions, I don't necessarily agree with, but I was fascinated by the history, weren't you? I mean, what did you make of all that? Because I haven't had you on since we started talking about it.
Well, I think I told you this, when we did chat offline, that it really gets down to what is supposed to be your philosophy for dealing with, dealing with other countries, dealing with hotspots of the world. Should we just stay out of it for the most part? Should we see horrible situations like Rwanda was or some of those and say, well, we have the capacity to make that stop. Should we get in and do that as sort of, big cop to the world? Those are the kinds of questions that you have to be asking. And that's not what drives it. What drives it is we refer to it as our national interest, but it's our national business interest as much as anything else. Some of it is spy versus spy stuff. So we spent a long time saying, well, whatever the Russians are doing, we have to counter it. Some of it is strictly, if you look at Middle East policy, you can't divorce that from oil.
Yeah.
So access to oil, access to energy has always been a big part of Middle East policy. And the question is, what kind of consistent principles can you apply to any of this? Because I think that's our biggest problem, is it's not principled. We don't discuss it that way. In the political world, nobody's going to talk about what should be our foreign policy principles. Nobody is going to ever have that conversation in this presidential campaign, and we haven't. I can't remember when we had it in a presidential campaign. Instead, we get to slogans, we get to hot-button issues, we talk war on terror. Well, I guess we're all against terrorism.
This war on terror has been the biggest scam that I've ever heard in my lifetime. What exactly is it? It's a war against a feeling, a person. Anybody who doesn't like us is a terrorist. The whole idea that if we're having a war on, well, then stealing money from the government shouldn't be a public sport, like it happens with all these companies, right? If we're in a war, we should act like it, and not hang people for treason for stealing from the place and stuff. We don't do that.
And also remember, and I know Carl has pointed this out, when we're participating in a war, then we're kind of fair game too, and it's people from overseas have a hard time attacking the United States, but as an example, if we're giving Ukraine the guns, the money, everything they need to fight the Russians, would not, and I'm not encouraging this and I'm not hoping it happens, but would not the Russians be justified in saying, U.S., you're a combatant here too, and therefore U.S. or Poland or whoever is supplying Ukraine, so you're part of it too, so your people are fair game for us to go after.
Well, the reason why the counter to that would be the Russians did everything they possibly could to bleep with us in Vietnam and send money and send stuff there, and we never attacked them.
I understand. So there seems to be some rule of engagement that you can pick a side and supply the side, but on the other hand, you can't. You're not really in it, and I think that's that's a little bit weird to think of it that way. But how many times have we seen whether it's a Mitt Romney who says, well, we're achieving our national objectives by funding Ukraine, and not one American life is lost.
And a lot of people feel that way, and there's some truth to it.
Yeah, and there is some truth to it, but isn't that a tacit admission that it's just a proxy war?
We're
achieving our objectives, and we're just letting somebody else die for it.
You're a little younger, but people my age might say, I'm not in this camp. It's payback for the two buddies I lost in Vietnam with a Russian bullet.
How about this?
That's not where I come from, but I mean, that's not my thought, but
I know what you're saying. You get people like Eric Swalwell, who, you know, his tweet that I saw was, funding Ukraine creates a lot of American jobs. We should talk about that more.
Well, sure it does.
Wait a minute. That's what's behind this? We're creating American jobs?
Well, I mean,
it may be true, but what do you mean we should talk about that more? This is a policy objective now? This is a jobs program. I see. This is what I mean by, you know, we have no guiding principles here. And that's, you know, if you really want to go back, you can still screw up. You can still screw up foreign policy big time, but you at least have to have some principles behind it. We deal with it case by case depending on what our interest is at the moment.
Kevin, a lot of this is, by the way, I surely as hell, people know that the reason why I do this show is because I learn every day. I mean, I'm never going to say that I'm an expert on everything, because the more I know, the more I know I don't know. And I don't know how many people think that way, but I sure do. Go back to World War II, Kevin. If you were to give everybody a quiz, even in schools where kids maybe even heard the name of World War II, everybody will tell you that it was a miracle on earth that we, all of a sudden, the Japanese snuck in, bombed Pearl Harbor, and the next day we turned on our industrial might, and within 2 months we're popping out battleships and carriers and God knows what. Nothing could be further from the truth. The fact is, we the president and people knew that we were in a woeful shape in terms of people, an army, a navy, everything in the early 30s, and we saw this happening over in Hitler, and there were people who essentially got on board early in terms of designing stuff, and we had battleship designs, we had aircraft carrier designs. This didn't happen. We had airplane designs. All that stuff takes years, months, years. You don't just start building something. And the thing that really got us going was when the war started and we weren't in it, Britain and France and Russia were buying stuff from us.
It was lend-lease.
My uncle was at the Pullman plant making Lancaster tanks for the British. And we were testing out landing craft in Lake Calumet.
I say lend-lease tongue-in-cheek.
I know, but I'm saying...
That
was actually old destroyers that we had from World War One. Most of it, or a lot of it. But that was stuff we already had. But I'm saying we were actually building stuff for them. So we really had at least a 2-year head start on these factories getting going. Spectacular, but to say that it didn't start till December of 1941 is untrue. So the people now that are saying we are woefully behind in the other kind of war that we haven't fought in so long and hopefully we'll never fight again, we're really good at the Navy SEALs piling in and in 2 days we win, right? Or in 3 days we win without a whole lot of loss of heavy equipment. We're really not set up for a war where we lose 4 aircraft carriers out of 12 and we're trying to scramble to keep the other ones out there. And we're not set up for an artillery war or something, some other place where we run through our utility shells in 4 months and there's nobody to make any new ones. So to the extent that this is an opportunity, for lack of a better term, to get those industries running again, I'm sure people are going to take it as that, right? I mean, whether it should be or shouldn't be, I don't know if it's during my call, but is it part of the thing that all of a sudden there's a bunch of jobs there? Well, yeah.
Yeah, that's byproduct of it, though.
Yeah.
And the way Swalwell presented it is we should be patting ourselves on the back for this great jobs program we have.
There are people, my cousin, my mother's cousin's one of them, bright guy, super bright guy, aerospace engineer, says, you know, if it wasn't for the arms trade that people now are competing with us in it, 25 years ago, if you got shot anywhere in the world, it was, what, an 80% chance it was an American bullet? I mean, that's been part of us for a long time, feeding all the people on both sides of these wars. Right?
Yeah. Again, guiding principles here?
Well,
What's the unspoken principle?
Well, I think, Kevin, real quick, because we're going to go to Jan, or he can just pile in if he wants, but I think there's, as time goes by, you know, and as I get older, I look at the Constitution as one of the greatest documents, if not the greatest document ever put together. You know, certainly ranking up there with maybe the Magna Carta, the Declaration of Independence, and maybe the Bible. But anyway, it has some flaws that seem to be playing out over time. One is, you know, I don't like the fact that people can influence elections in other areas. And I don't think those guys, even though if you're Scalia, who seemed to think he knew everything those guys thought, I don't think, even if he went through the notes of...
First of all, they do know what those guys were thinking.
Oh, yeah.
Because there's a lot written about all the thought process that goes
They know more than is just in the document. You're correct. But I don't think any of those guys could anticipate somebody from New Hampshire influence a House of Representatives election in South Carolina. I don't think they could... They can anticipate that.
They actually anticipated a lot.
Well, I don't think that's just
anticipated a lot by creating a process for amending the Constitution.
Well, okay, but it's not going to get changed because the money is not going to let it get changed. They also made an amendment pretty darn tough. My point is, as
it should be.
I don't think they anticipated the rise of the modern corporation. Because their mentality was, no matter who you are, you died. Corporations don't die. They never anticipated. I mean, if you and I could be the biggest schmucks on earth, we could make it to Washington, and if we're there for 12 years, 15 years, 20 years, even with our great personalities, Kevin, how many of the 435 people that govern, plus the president and the Supreme Court, how many people could we actually co-opt before we croaked? Not very many, but... Guess what? Exxon's been around a long time. There probably isn't a person there they haven't greased or these drug companies. It's just different. But what I wanted to get to this one is that my third one is, except for during World War II, when we had a guy who was elected four times, didn't serve his last term out, where we had that continuity in government. The British form of government, even though there's weaknesses there too, seems to have a much more long-term policy when it comes to other countries than we do. We really shouldn't be shifting, are we going to support a place or not support a place every 4 years? That kind of a swing. Or we're either going to, I mean, you mentioned earlier, do we really want to get involved in this stuff? Well, you and I, we love world trade, right? It makes things cheaper and better for people. Can you have a bunch of people running out and sinking ships in the Red Sea? The answer is no, or you don't have any world trade. Now, who polices that, who doesn't, who has the capability of doing it? These are all big issues, but I don't think you can have people doing stuff like that. And have the rest of the, you know, there needs to be some cop someplace, you would think, that says, no, you can't go out and do that. Now, who is it? And why are they, you know?
And so that takes me back to my original question is, you know, what is intervention policy here? What is the guiding principles or when we do and when we don't intervene in something going on elsewhere?
In my round the world crazy way of doing stuff, I'm trying to answer it. What I'm saying is that answer should be something that the best people in Congress, both parties, should somehow be involved in, and other people shouldn't realize that that's going to change every time there's an election. I don't know how we ever get to that, but...
Part of the reason it doesn't change completely, I mean, it does seem to have changed more, because I think the reason it's changed more lately is because Congress has abdicated its responsibilities in so many areas to presidential orders, you know, to executive orders. And so that's a different problem. Congress should not abdicate that responsibility. And as a result, you know, we allow people to do all kinds of things. And that's why every time we replace an administration, we lurch back and forth. what's supposed to smooth that out is the idea that we do have people in the diplomatic corps who are consistent from one administration to the next.
Not very many.
Not as many as we used to, but we do have a lot of people, and that was part of the purpose. Their purpose there is to just smooth it out and keep us from lurching back and forth.
I think, Kevin, Jack can opine on this, I think that every one of those people resigns, and the president can ask them to stay. But in Britain, again, I'm not a big push for that.
I bet you Trump wished they all resigned when...
I think they do.
When they wound up undermining.
Well, I mean, I think that virtually everybody... It's some huge number. It's 1,500 or 2,000 people resign in a change of administration. Where in Britain, you flip a prime minister, the guy whose job it is to be the Undersecretary of State for South America, he's, there's issues with this, but he's a career guy. He knows all his governments. He's probably been there 25, 30 years. Now, maybe there's a weakness there. Not like you can't change him, but he doesn't automatically quit. I think everybody in the Secretary of State's office, it's the other party, I think down like three or four layers, they all submit their resignation. It's a massive amount of people. Because every president now is always bitching that the Congress won't approve the new people. John,
Tom, I get that, but also think through, because we had a lot of that laid bare when it came time for us to, during the first Trump impeachment. And a lot of that was laid bare when we saw who the Vindmans and the Victoria Nulands and all of those people who had been there forever. They did not leave.
They didn't
like the president, didn't agree with him from a policy standpoint. They were going nowhere.
I'm going to say that. Where's Jan? Pipe in here.
I think
he kept them on.
No, they were not his appointees. Go ahead.
No.
Morning, Kevin. Tom. Well, Newland had been in there since, I think, the Clinton years. She was there for all Bush one, his two terms, for Obama's two terms, and left when Trump was elected, and then came back in, when Biden was elected. So these people tend to not only hang around, but to direct policy, sometimes completely flagrantly going in the opposite direction from what the executive.
I'm not saying it doesn't happen. I'm getting Wayne Manson on here because I've read somewhere, of course I will never be able to find it, but the amount of resignations turned in is, and most of the time the guy will just say no, you can stay or don't stay. And I think Trump did a lot of that because he didn't have 1,500 people. What if we got in? We wouldn't know 1,500 new people. We'd keep half of the people or more, wouldn't we?
Well, there's levels of foreign service officers in the State Department. Those are career positions, and they go from place to place. They are technically nonpartisan in that they are there, push American interests, to keep people trusting.
I'll bet, John, you get. We'll bet a beer because we'll see each other soon. I'll bet there's 50 to 100 resignations in the State Department alone was a change. Now, they may say no, I don't want you quitting. I think
the ideologues who are there to push, a partisan position, of course, are not going to stay if they can't get their way, or if they know that there's such hostility to their viewpoint that they're going to have to wait for another election to get back in again. So those people do drift in and out.
The next administration's 8 years, they're not hanging around looking for a job for 8 years. That's a long way.
Well, they all got possible positions in think tanks, teaching, and everything else. No, there are no tag days for them.
They don't go away.
They never go away.
They find different holes to hide out in.
Right.
All right. Now wait a minute. How can we get a job in a think tank? And what do you do all day other than think?
You tank.
You stuck up.
I mean, why aren't we in one of these things?
That'll be my next job. I keep saying when I'm ready to retire from teaching, I'll. Hand out carts at Walmart or work on the dispensary. My dream job, of course, would be to be a part-time Zamboni driver.
Oh yeah, that'd be perfect.
But which would be an absolutely fabulous job. But maybe, just maybe, we can start up a think tank.
Can you think from home, or you got to go in the office?
Remotely.
You got to go to the office.
It's a tank.
At home, you got to buy your own lunch.
Well, plus, if it's a tank, you got to be in there with the other fish, right? I mean, they're all thinking together. Yeah. Well, you know.
All right, well, fellas, I'm going to drop out and get myself to the office. So
why don't you do some research?
I'll leave this poop show in your able hands.
So while you're on the road, why don't you, you're Mr. Googleman. Why don't you find out what an entry level think tank guy makes? Maybe we should do it.
We can entry level. I ain't doing no entry level. Hey, by the way, there's just to close one loop. You're thinking of the 76-77 Bulls who got knocked out of the playoffs by the Bill Walton Portland Trail Blazers, who wound up going on to win the title. And that particular team did have Bob Love, so it had Norm Van Leer, Bob Love, Artis Gilmore, Scott May as a rookie.
Yeah.
And he was pretty good as a rookie. He was a 15 points a game guy. He just got injured a lot and didn't have much of a career. And then Mickey Johnson was the other starter, if you remember Mickey Johnson.
Yeah, so Chet Walker was gone and Sloan was gone.
Yeah, so those guys were gone. And then you had, people like Wilbur Holland, John Mengel, Jack Maron, some old veterans. Tom Boerwinkel was still on that team. So that was an interesting team. But I do remember Walton saying that the best player he faced all year was Artis Gilmore.
Well, the guy was the guy that took the shot from the bench that won the last game for him, the left-handed guy. What the hell was his name? He was a total bull killer. What was his name?
For Portland?
Yeah.
For Portland, let's see. That team was... had people like Johnny Davis. It could have been Johnny Davis.
No.
Bobby Grove. Oh, it was Lionel Hollins.
Lionel Hollins. That guy killed the Bulls. Absolutely killed the Bulls.
Yeah, that guy was a good ball player. I remember him.
They had, what's the guy from Marquette in there, too? The big forward, right?
Maurice Lucas. Total badass.
Oh, God, yeah. Boy, yeah, how many
really,
fights
really
did he get in?
Ball player. And he was, as I'm looking at this, he was actually their leading scorer. He was 20 points a game to Walton's 18.6.
Yeah, he was a serious player, boy, and you didn't want to mess with him.
Yeah, and, just really, and then, Lionel Hollins, Bobby Gross, Dave Twardzik, and then Herm Gilliam off the bench, and Johnny Davis off the bench. Really, really, really good team basketball.
And the Bulls almost beat him. If it wasn't for Holland winging one in from the cheap seats, they would have beat him. Just saying.
Yeah, that's probably true. Let's see. The playoff run there, and that was first round versus the Bulls.
Yeah.
It was a 2-1. It was a mini series, so it was 2-1.
Those were some good teams. We had a lot less teams, so the teams were pretty stacked.
Yeah.
All right, Kevin, you can dash off. We're not going to go to break. We'll just stick with John. The Spoons are now down 11:50. Nasdaq down 63. Like I say, we're down, but we're up. I mean, I can tell you, we did in the QQQs, we sold some calls on Friday morning, $12 out of the money and another $12 in the money. So that's a, 5-6% move in like 3 days. That's like a real lot. Who knows if we're going to come back down here today or not. So, Jan, we've talked to, a bunch of different things this week, and it all seems like it's the same theme. Is anybody putting, this stuff together? We've got budget issues, we've got policy issues, we've got election issues with, I'm going to say, these guys, whatever side you're on, we're going to make it to this election without any discussion whatsoever of the stuff that everybody on this show, right or left, cares about. Or am I being too jaded?
Well, not too jaded, somewhat jaded, but I'm probably as jaded or more jaded too. So, I think we're really like losing some battles here, Tom. I was watching a piece last night on the evening news about the anticipated shortfall for Chicago's transit systems, predicting by 2026 there's going to be over a $700 million deficit that has to be closed. And you know what that will mean? It will be draconian service cuts and slash and burn tactics. And that's exactly what the city doesn't need at this point. What was most disturbing was to see how Chicago has lagged behind other cities in the ridership pre-COVID versus now. And, it's all linked together, I think, in Chicago's case. The numbers haven't bounced back. Because the perception is there's no place you want to go on transit unless you absolutely have to, if you have to use it for your job. But the idea of taking it downtown and spending an evening in the Loop or any place else out and about is too frightening for a lot of people. And they're not going to take public transportation anyway, just to get there and take their lives in their hands. So until that perception changes and people feel comfortable and safe getting on transit, these numbers are not going to come back. And I show Chicago has really missed the boat on this. And I don't see any panic button being pressed at City Hall about this or any place else. But it's going to mean, you know, a gradually descending mess if the transit system is cut in half, let's say, or L service or bus service is cut by 30-40%. That's going to create a much more drastic reduction as people stop using the system altogether if it doesn't serve them when they need it. So I think it's kind of pointless to be thinking about Ukraine and places around the world and Gaza and other things when we've got the total utter mess back home here that we have no interest in looking at or fixing.
We seem to not be able to do it without dishing out money to certain people. I mean, if anybody doesn't think, I mean, the mayor in the city, if anybody, whatever, I mean, everybody, gives me this, I guess on this show, I am the flaming liberal, especially since Brennan's not here. Hopefully he'll be back soon. But the fact is, I'm not. I'm pretty much in the middle, and I'm just one of these people that feels that I never want to be in a position, whatever side I'm on, that there is an issue that I can't look at the issue and decide for myself which side I'm on, rather than if it's a right issue or a left issue, I got to think that way. I'm never going to go there, and I honestly don't think other people should do that either, but they do, so I'm not going to change them. But this issue in the city, and I don't know whether it's black, white, somewhere along the line, the Ku Klux Klan was a white problem. Okay, I mean, it was a serious problem among white people that didn't like black people and were willing to do a lot of damage. Somewhere along the line, we have in this city, anybody who says, and we have guys from the city, even I happen to like the new police chief, I think he's trying to do a pretty good job, with a very young force, a lot of good people have retired. He's undermanned, experience and numbers. He's seemingly stopped by, nobody wants to stop anybody, they can't stop anybody, and yet we have a problem here with 25 cars full of youths in hoodies and masks, armed to the teeth, blacked out windows, driving every night, causing mayhem. Last night a group robbed 3 stores, 10 minutes apart. We have to find a way to stop that from happening. Now, if we decide we're going to pull everybody over with blackened windows. I don't have blackened windows, but if I did and I got pulled over, whatever it is, we're going to do it. Or you can't just say we're powerless, John, because we're losing people right and left, and everybody is hunkered down in their houses. And you look at the amount of shootings, they're going on in broad daylight in neighborhoods that I drive through. It's not like, I'm aware of this. I'm very aware. And, and I use all kinds of different things now when I drive in those areas, where I always make sure I have a spot if I'm at a stoplight where I can get out of there, that kind of thing. But, I mean, to think that we don't have a problem is the most ignorant thing I've ever heard. And then when other people react and say, I'm afraid, to say there's something wrong with them, you can't coach fear. I mean, you can tell me that 90% of the snakes in the world aren't poisonous, and if all of a sudden I'm riding my bike or I'm walking, I see one coiled in front of me, I'm going to get out of the way. You can't coach me to say, oh, you don't have to move, Tom. That's probably not a poisonous snake. It's not the way we're wired, right? And when we see people driving around for doing no good, and we're powerless to stop them, nobody wants to be in that environment. There's no freedom there. I mean, my buddy John Lee, hopefully now that he's back, we'll have him on the air because he knows. He moved to Singapore, and he hated it because he's a very liberal guy. When he first got there, and it took him 6 months or however long to get his videotapes back when we had VHS, because somebody had to watch them all to make sure there was nothing bad in there, right? Which is not something we want here. he hated the fact that the newspaper had to basically be run through the government. But after being there 5 or 6 years, he goes, you know, my family is so much freer here than we were in Chicago. My kids are 10. They get on a bus at 11 o'clock at night if they're studying at their buddies. I don't even worry about them. I haven't locked my car. I haven't locked my house. Kid takes a cab home at 10 o'clock. Not a problem. You don't fear for anything. He goes, I don't like the place in the sense that, you know, that they're watching me and all that kind of stuff. But he goes, on day-to-day life, there's no comparison to how free I am here than I am in Chicago. And I couldn't believe he said that. But now I think about it, that's kind of true, Jen.
It's absolutely true, Tom. I always felt as a kid I was somewhat, you know, kept on a short leash, and I would have liked to have, you know, gone around and seen more, and, you know, been free to do things and not constantly be accountable to whomever. But when I look back on it, and part of it's age, I think a lot of it is age, but I felt, you know, compared to how I feel today, I felt utterly free. Now, I mean, everything is a, you know, calculus of risks that, you know, most of which I have no interest in even trying to play the odds with. I feel that there's really nothing that I can depend on in a pinch to help me stave off an attack. If somebody wants to rob me, if somebody wants to knock me down or shoot me, whatever else, there's nothing I could do to prevent that from happening. And I doubt that anybody who would do that would be likely to be caught or imprisoned for any length of time or anything else. So I think our tolerance of this has clearly just gone out, you know, in spades. There was a piece in the Sun-Times the other day, a letter to the editor about, you know, changing the default speed limit in Chicago from 30 to 25. But of course, you know, what difference does this make if you have people going 100 and there's no penalty? And, you know, this kind of freedom, where, you know, the crooks get to write the rules and everybody else has to abide by them. This is what people got fed up with in the 20s and 30s in Chicago.
Well, you and I can argue about just about anything, but you know I'm not Mr. Law and Order guy, but I had, who the hell am I having a show a couple weeks ago? I had was it Joel's buddy? I don't know, somewhere or other we were talking about crime and punishment, and they said, well, you've proven you can't stop stuff by arresting people, and I'm going, wait a minute. Other countries manage to do it, and I don't want to be Saudi Arabia, where if somebody steals twice, you cut their arm off. But I mean, the fact that the idea of saying you can't do it is BS. You can do it. The question is, what price do you wish to pay? I mean, if you were to put for 6 months 10 times the police on the Ryan and the Stevenson and the Eisenhower, and you say, like they do in Canada, what's in kilometers? So you know, whatever. Let's say, for instance, speed limit 55. Over 70, $150. Over 85, $500. Over 95, car impounded. Which to me would make perfect sense, right? I mean,
it's perfect sense.
And so the first weekend, you impound 30 cars. Now you're not going to get everybody. Second weekend or during the week, there's another 40 or 50. At some point, probably after the third week, people wake up and say, wait a minute, you got my car and I can't get it for 2 weeks and I got to go to court to get it back. We got to go through all the illegal searches and seizures, and is it really the person's car? I mean, I don't know as much about that. You're the attorney, but would you create a difference over a period of time? The answer is yes, you would. Without a doubt, you would. People don't do that in Ohio where they care about it. They don't do it in some other states where they care about it. They do it here because we've decided there's nothing we can do about it. My buddy Monty, who got his car stolen on North Avenue, coming out of the Jiffy Lube, guy jumps out of the car, hops in, and takes off. Now, he only had 3 miles left on his gas, so they dumped it because they didn't want to buy gas, right? Now, the police could give a crap. Oh man, you got it back? Or they broke the ignition? He ended up getting the money from the Jiffy Lube for the ignition, and no harm. They want to look at it. Now, John, if you were to take 1 out of 10 of these incidents a day, and actually send a forensics team, get your ass out of the office and get over there and do something, If they were to dust that car down for fingerprints, granted the people had a hoodie and a mask, and I know my buddy Bill was telling me last night fingerprints aren't as foolproof as they once were, and he's a serious defense attorney. Jan, I gotta believe that if you got one out of there from one of these guys, they're in the system somewhere. If they knew that 1 in 25 chance a squad car is going to pull up in front of their house and pile them in the back seat and take them to jail for stealing the car, these people are not that stupid. If they think there's a second, they're going to get caught. If every one of these guys that you pull over, why don't we have a jail? Let's open up Joliet again, for God's sake. Instead of going to county, you're going to Joliet for a week while we figure out what's going to happen to you. Are you a juvenile? Are you in school? Do you have a family? Do you do something? I mean, now if we let you out, what's going to happen? Is there a family to go back to? Is there a school you've ever attended? We don't know anything. We just let everybody back out. That's not enforcement. That's not even doing the perpetrator any good, John. We're not doing anything right.
Well, we prefer not to know those things.
They prefer not to know. But just like the people that are the immigrants by me, they're all Home Depot looking for. Do we even interview these guys? There might be 10 nurses in there. There probably isn't, but what if there is? We have a nursing shortage, for God's sake. We don't want to know, John. You're right. We don't want to know. Why is that?
This is a laziness to a town that really frosts me, because it isn't like we didn't. We always did, you know, cared about these things to some extent, and at some point we stopped caring about them, or just kind of, you know, threw up our hands and said that, you know, this is not worth our time or effort to try to fight or, you know, give any kind of alternative to. But the idea that, you know, back in the 20s and 30s when the police were bought off in many cases by organized crime and looked the other way, the police, you know, knew what they were doing. They knew the price that everybody was paying for their lack of interest in what was happening, and it still happened. Nowadays, it's not so much that the police are on the take.
I think,
but
John,
they're completely intimidated and frightened.
We're gonna argue about the 30s when we weren't here. You might have been. You're a little older than me. They were getting paid off for the speakeasy. I don't think you could drive down the street and run through stop signs and red lights and not get pulled over. I don't think they were bought off to that extent, the police. I mean, right now,
especially like in the Black Belt on the South Side, when Thompson, Republican's mayor, the reason he got, you know, almost unanimous black support was because he told black voters, I'm telling the cops, it's hands off. If you want to have prostitution, if you want to have gambling, you put numbers rack, whatever you want, go ahead and do it. We're not going to raid your parties. We're not going to, you know, arrest you on the street. We're not going to be interested in whatever, you know, stuff you feel like you want to do and you can make money off of. We're going to concentrate our forces elsewhere. And boy, the voters really liked that, and that's why, you know, he served 3 terms, not consecutively. But it wreaked havoc in other parts of the city, including in the Black Belt, where things were pretty much up for grabs. But that was his political platform.
I know you're right, but I'm saying in terms of you and I could walk down the street without fear. There's a difference. I mean, we weren't invited to the prostitute party or the gambling. My uncle had a poker game in his saloon. They paid off the local cops. But you could walk in the saloon, have a beer, and not get shot.
Well, yeah, and you didn't have to participate in the gambling, and you weren't at risk of being shot if you were in there.
I mean, I remember.
Usually, lots of stuff did happen too, but generally, people didn't go looking for trouble then any more than they do now, Tom. But there was trouble around. It's just that, you know, there were pockets of it where it flourished, and other places where it wasn't tolerated at all.
Well,
that wasn't fair either. But,
I mean, we're on, as usual, two different parts of the chessboard. I mean, I'm not about to say that in the 60s, what I'm talking about, the mid 60s, that there were still mob hits. There was all kinds of stuff, right? I mean, that happened. But I also know that when we were 12, 13, 14 years old, we would take the 103rd Street bus to Western, to 63rd, and go toward the, and once you crossed Ashland, and this should never have been, the area was 99% black. We'd get off, because the L only went to Loomis at the time. We'd get off, we'd walk up, we'd get on the L, and there's like four of us, and we're the only, not really, I mean, there'd be other people because it was the last stop, but the clientele in the middle of the day was mostly black, a lot of younger kids, especially in the summertime. And we never had a problem. Nobody ever looked cross-eyed at us. We kept our mouth shut. We didn't bother anybody. Nobody bothered us. Can you imagine somebody from the South Side letting their 13-year-old kid go take the L up to Wrigley Field and on the bus now?
Well, no.
We're not even on the same planet, are we? Now, part of it is you don't expect these kids to do anything. My mother grew up at a very young age. You're supposed to be a creature of your environment. And she was probably on a bus when she was 10, you know, because that's what you did. You weren't afraid to go around. It didn't mean there weren't mob guys and there wasn't people sticking stuff up. But as a kid, you had nothing to fear, except maybe another kid your age, and worse could happen is you get in a fist fight, right? That people don't even remember how safe it was to do stuff like that. Never even crossed your mind that somebody bother you.
I knew trouble riding the buses and the L's on the South Side when I was in high school and after.
High school got a little trickier. Got a little trickier when we got a little older.
Yeah, and I was assaulted as an adult on the CTA bus just coming home from work. I was the only white on the bus. This is after I was out of college. I can't feel too racially charged about the incident because the people who rescued me were also African American. The assailant was an African-American. It's kind of an embarrassing thing all the way around. But I stopped riding that bus after that and found other ways to commute to work. I wasn't any idiot. I wasn't doing something where I risked that kind of encounter. I was not at fault in any way. I was reading a book, minding my own business. And I thought, well, okay, I don't have to put up with this. I'm just earning a pittance salary, trying to work downtown and come back home to the South Side. But, that was, I accepted that as the way things were, and of course it's much worse now because you've got whole stretches where nobody wants to be seen on the street.
There's a huge split. Obviously, if you take the Brown Line in, you can't get on the thing, right? It's jammed. I used to once in a while drop my truck off when I had the Suburban at my guy on the South Side. He's at 91st and Kedzie, right? And I'd just hop the Kedzie bus there, at 9 in the morning. I'd drop it off. And at that time, the Kedzie bus runs you down to the Orange Line station. It's the same driver every morning, right? I mean, I rode the thing, five times over 3 years. I recognized the guy. The same people get on at every stop. Everybody's friendly. Somebody gets on handicapped. Everybody gets up out of that area, helps the person on, gives them the handicapped spot, goes in the back, gets another seat. I mean, it's the world that ought to be, right? Yet, I don't think anybody is anxious to take the Kedzie bus at 11 at night. I mean, you wouldn't think about it, would you? I mean, I wouldn't. I mean, so there's like the tale of two cities. If you're in can you imagine taking a 79th Street bus from all the way east to west? What are the chances of doing that without a problem? The only thing you can do is sit there acting like you're a cop with your hand in your jacket like there's a gun there. You might get away with it if you do that, but it's not like it was. We'll just take the bus. There's no problem. Well, there is a problem.
I have had reason to take buses in Chicago, recently, very late at night, when there's no cabs and I don't use Uber or ride sharing. I feel a lot safer on a bus town than I do on the L. Even in the, midday, perfectly normal commuting time. I don't trust the L's anymore because stuff can happen there and nobody on the train is going to help you, least of all the conductor who doesn't even know you exist and is, 200 feet away from you. So I just think, on a bus you can sit next to the driver, you're visible, people looking on the street can see you. It's you've got a fighting chance, I think, even in the toughest neighborhood if you're on a bus.
Well, Dan, we're going to go to break. When we come back and I think there's somewhat of a difference you're seeing now, the people with a lot of money. I think the absence of the exchanges here and the people who work there has caused an irreparable harm to downtown. And I don't know how you get that back or what you replace it with. Biotech, maybe, something like that, becoming another Boston. There needs to be a driver here someplace. one of my friends thinks it's the hospitals, that's the avenue you want to go and have, some of the drug companies here and those kinds of things. Let's talk about after breaks. But futures now down 18. We're continuing to leak. NASDAQ down 97. Again, it's, it pales in comparison to how much we've been up the last few days, but it's worse than we were earlier. We'll be right back. Stocks and Jacks.
This self-directed trading is a lonely job. Online trading is not as easy as point and click.
No, it's not. Everyone, even professionals, need to share ideas and think out loud every now and then.
That's what I like about PTI Pro Direct. Their staff of former option floor traders really helps me choose the right strategy for trading option volatility and plan the time decay for my covered writing program.
Yep, nothing can replace years of trading experience to stop you from making that dumb trade and for saving a few bucks. We've all been there and done that.
Yeah, I have access to all that great trading advice and experience for just a penny a share for stocks, $1 for equity options, and $1 minimum a trade.
Our clients at PTI Pro Direct can call when they need a little help on a trade or just to talk about the market in general. We trade every day. We love this stuff.
That's what I like most about PTI Pro Direct. Cheap prices along with great advice from real floor traders. It's the best of both worlds.
Tell your friends. That's PTIProDirect.com. PTIProDirect.com.
This self-directed...
Hi, I'm Audrey Johnson, an owner of Home Source Realty and a frequent contributor to Stocks and Jocks. If you're nervous about the stock market and considering diversification, or are looking for a rate of return way better than your banks, consider adding rental properties to your portfolio. Whether it's a condo, single family, or multi-unit building, I can help you select a property that meets your financial needs. Call or text me at 708-349-3456. That's 708-349-3456. Or visit my website at myhomesourcerealty.com. That's myhomesourcerealty.com.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now. Right here, right now. Right now.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tom Howell. And we're on the board. S&P futures now down 20. NASDAQ futures down 105. Leaking some. Leaking some. Dow futures down 58. I still can't see anything in the Dow. I got Amazon down a $1.69. So maybe that's down a little bit. But not really nobody down like a whole bunch. I've got Meta down 344. I've got, well, NVIDIA is down 977. But they were back over 900, which they hadn't been for a while. So there you go. Over in Europe, which was up pretty strong earlier, we'll see what they're doing now. They're still up, but not as much. DAX up 29.2%. I think they were up 0.5% earlier. FTSE up 23.3%. CAC around up 58.7%. So still buoyant over there, but kind of leaking down a little with us. Nikkei, kind of a big whack last night, down 632, 1.6%. Hang Seng down 165.9%. Still way above 18,000, 18,313. Shanghai down 19, that's 0.6%, 31.28. Yesterday was inside day. Dow up 31, S&P up 7, NASDAQ down 17. Just, it was a snoozer. Bonds up 2 basis points, 4.48. It's kind of the first uptick there. It's probably why people maybe are thinking the rallies might be over, at least for a couple days. The Bund up 3 basis points, 2.45. Japan up 2 basis points, 0.89. So kind of right where it has been. Oil down now $1.04. 77.34, Brent down 108, that's 82.08, natural gas up 6 cents, 226, again, was a buy for like the fourth time down around $1.70, did I buy it any of those times? No. Gold up 30 cents now, 23.24, silver up 5 cents, 27.59, copper down 6 cents, 4.53, foreign exchange, the dollar is pretty much unchanged at 107 against the euro, and 125 against the British pound. Bitcoin was down earlier, it's still down. On 864 to 62,237. What do you got for us, Trevi Weather Sports?
All right, it is 7:37 here in Chicago, Wednesday, May 8th. Starting off with a little bit of sports here. We got some baseball. The Diamondbacks won over the Reds 6-2. The White Sox lost to the Rays 1-5. And the Padres lost to the Cubs. The Cubs win 2-3. Over to Chicago weather, it's currently 59 degrees. We got sunny skies. It'll stick around for most of the day, but we're going to get some rain overnight, possibly, that is, around a 48% chance. We're also going to have high of 71 today, and that's going to hit around 2 p.m. Over in Phoenix, they are currently at 65 degrees. They're going to have sunny skies. It'll stick around all day. They're going to have a high of 90 degrees. It's going to hit around 3 p.m. Now, finally, for Chicago traffic, looks like just in the past 2 minutes or so, our little traffic report here has cleared up the two accidents on the inbound Kennedy. So still pretty heavy traffic here coming in. Things are pretty delayed all the way back to Lawrence Avenue going into downtown. There is still the accident still being worked on the outbound Eisenhower. Looks like that is right before Des Plaines Avenue. It looks like not all the lanes are blocked off as they were, but we are still feeling the effects of all these accidents. So if you're on the inbound Kennedy or the outbound Eisenhower, expect some pretty heavy delays today. That is all I got. Back to you, Chief.
John, it was funny, you remember my stepfather, who's kind of a character, but he's a real bright guy. Went to DePaul and the GI Bill, became an accountant and all that stuff, ended up working his way up, you know, to be VP of a pretty big corporation kind of thing. Anyway, he had some health issues, so I had to drive him to work a lot, and he would tell me that he ended up working over here for Waltham Watch, and then Hallmark Rings. People remember Hallmark Rings. I mean, they're probably still around somewhere. We had this secretary/assistant, and she was of Cuban descent way before people, you know, a lot of Cuban people here. Tell you what, Jen, if we want to hire people by nationality, that's not a bad pick, but because she ran everything. And if he even attempted to try and do something that she thought was her job, she'd like snap at him. Hey, that's what I do here. But you know, he would tell me, he goes, you know, she's married some guy, obviously. The guy has a job, a good job, and he has a car. And he says, do you have any idea what an advantage it is to be in a city like Chicago, downtown, where she can hop safely on the L, which is a couple blocks from her house, be here very rapidly. At the time, it was for like a buck. Her total cost of transportation is like $2. And it's safe, it's fast, air conditioned. That what if it wasn't for that, how much I would have to pay in the burbs, where somebody'd have to have a car, they'd have to, well, maybe you don't have to pay to park in the burbs. He goes, it's such an advantage. He goes, let's just hope we never lose it. And this was, God, 40 years ago the guy was telling me this. And now it's a disadvantage, and we don't want those people coming down easily to downtown, because look what it's done to the loop. Don't our city fathers, whoever they call these guys now, don't they have any idea when you let an advantage like that turn into a disadvantage, like what the movies Escape from New York, where you couldn't get on the subways in New York for a while or something, that turns into a disadvantage. What it does to a place, these guys don't even understand, or do they?
Well, I think the people running the CTA don't understand. And I don't think the people in City Hall or many of the aldermen understand it either. And they don't feel any particular, you know, responsibility to change it or to address it.
Okay,
anyway.
Right. So, John, I'm sorry to interrupt, but if you and I get put in the head of the CTA and we say, okay, there's only one way to clean this up, and that every morning we're going to pick a train, Blue Line, Red Line probably are the worst, and God knows, well, probably are the worst. I don't think the Brown Line's a problem. And every morning we're gonna have a police presence at a stop. We're gonna stop the train and we're gonna put 15 cops on the thing. Anybody who's like living here, anybody who looks like they got a gun, anybody who is eating or doing all the stuff you're not supposed to do here, we're taking them off, we're putting them on a bus, and we're getting them hell out of here. And after a month of that, I think you clean it up. Now, those people, who knows? Half of them might have mental problems. Half of them don't have a place to live, whatever it is, let's deal with it somehow, just not on the train. What support do you think they would get for that? Zero. But you and I know that's what has to happen.
Yeah, and you know, if you had conductors on trains, more than just the one, you know, motor person operating the doors and the equipment, that would give a lot of people, you know, some sort of comfort that, well, if something goes wrong here, if there's somebody who's watching it, seeing it happen, and can immediately get the police here faster than I can hit the button. You know, how are they going to hire enough people to give people that kind of comfort level, Tom, when they're already...
Well, let me ask you this. Let me turn the question around. if they're broke, the idea of hiring these people to put two people on a train would certainly not be anybody's solution by the numbers, correct?
Right.
Yet, when you took the people off the train for this alleged savings, you're more broke now than you were then. How can they both be right?
Well, they drove people away from riding the system.
Well, I mean, I think the overhead, if you were to take the salaries and stuff of the top 100 people, you'd find that the money went there, or at least some of it. I mean, where did the money go? I mean, we got rid of, and every train, how many trains are riding around the city right now at any given time? 100? 150? Maybe 200? So, okay, we got rid of 200 people. Where's the savings? Well, there isn't any. Okay, well, why not? We can't put them back there. Look what it'll cost. Yeah, but where was the savings when you took them out of there?
Well, I think the problem now, Tom, and this is, I don't know how this plays into the deficit issue, but I think there are so many no-shows on any given day at all levels of the PTA. This is what is, I think, a major, cause of the disruption to, on-time service. And I've got stories to tell about the buses that, the only way I can attribute it to anything is that some bunch of people didn't show up for work today or use the sick day, just didn't feel like, making the trip in, and they're getting paid, but nobody's doing the work, and the passengers are paying the price for it. So, at some level, there has to be, a tighter control over what is really going on, because they're clearly not saving money or making the system leaner or meaner. It's certainly meaner, maybe, but unless they do hire a bunch more people and fill the trains with people who are there to keep order, 24 hours, it's either that or we're not going to have 24 hours.
Well, you need to put a lot of resources to bear to clean it up. And, the idea that you have some homeless people in the street, some homeless people on the trains, it's a big problem. But you've got to find a solution. You've got to interview, when was the last time you had a job? Well, it's been years. I mean, is it a mental issue? Are people that should be in the old Tinley? Is it when Ram, or was the guy who closed a lot of the mental health facilities, did he just kick them out on the street? And the sheriff said a lot of them just ended up in county jail. I mean, there needs to be some rationale to all this stuff. But I haven't taken the L in a bit. But the last couple times I took it during the daytime, I'd see some guys doing track work, right? The train had come by and it's real slow. You see all these people, dodging the train, and there's 8 or 10 people there, mostly guys. And one thing I learned from my Pullman experience, Jan, in order to do something, to start a railroad car, whatever it is you're building, there's always an operation sheet. The operation sheet is take part A and part B and put them together with bolt C using wrench D. Okay, so you need the piece of material, you need the screwdriver or the wrench, and you need the guy or girl. I see these people, there's 10 people out there on the track. Not one of them has a tool in their hand, be it a sledge or whatever the hell they're using, a crowbar. And not one of them, there's no bag of nails or something that somebody's going to pile in somewhere. What exactly are they doing? What are you doing up there without a tool in your hand, whatever your job is? I mean, if anybody went at this with some sort of a manufacturing engineering sort of view, what do you think the efficiency is of these people?
Well, it's plummeted.
Yeah,
I'd say. And it's not just the CTA. I mean, I can find all sorts of examples of where I think that there's no monitoring or quality concerns, managerial control. Nobody's paying any price for being a lackadaisical worker.
Well,
except the people who have the work done.
Everybody knows, this is a pet peeve of mine, everybody knows, or should know, if you're anywhere near Chicago, that the Kennedy has been bleeped up now. This is the second year. So you can't get on it at night at all. I mean, you might as well walk. But one of the other ways home to my place is Franklin Street. And there's a Franklin Street Bridge. Now, it's normally 3-lane or 2-lane or something. Well, it's down to 1 lane. Okay, and you might say, why is it down to 1 lane? Well, people are putting a new sidewalk in on one side. So they blocked that whole half of the bridge off, so the entire street has to funnel down to this 1 lane. It's probably the only way to get north, other than Halsted Street, other than the expressway. Jen, I've gone by there 3:45. They're already done working. There's nobody. I've never seen a worker there. How long does it take to put a new sidewalk on the bridge, for God's sake? It's wood, I think, or the composite now. I mean, this has become a 3-month job for these people. They're never there.
What happened to the incentives? You know, finish this job early and you get a bonus. You know, finish the job late, you still get the bonus, it looks like.
Evidently. I mean, what are they doing? I mean, why wouldn't somebody say, hey, that's a key way home now since the expressway's bleeped up. Hurry your ass up or get out of there. I mean, I don't think it was falling through the old side. I mean, there's no coordination. There's no smarts. That's why I really worry about this convention. I don't think that, even though I do think this new police chief's pretty good, actually. He seems like he is, but boy, he's dealing with what? A young force, a small force? People that are afraid to pull anybody over? I mean, that guy, boy, who'd want that job, for God's sake?
I'm with you, Tom. I don't think, you know, people are really taking seriously enough the kind of focal point Chicago's going to be for, you know, that week of August 19th.
Well, I'm hoping for
we still have evidence of people who want to, you know, meddle in the system and put up encampments and stop traffic and, you know, take over streets and everything else. We hardly, you know, can say we don't know these things have been happening for years now, with unbelievable effrontery too. But you lay the political, you know, machinery over this, and you've got people from all over the country who are going to want to be here and get their 15 minutes of fame and shoot their mouths off on social media. So I don't think, if things weren't as screwed up as they were on the national stage, maybe it wouldn't make so much difference. But we got a pattern of incompetency now that seems to be really ingrained in the system. And there's lots of people who know just how to take advantage of that.
Well, I don't, this thing in the Middle East is amazingly serious. I mean, there's no doubt that a lot of people are getting killed, were killed on one side, now they're getting killed on the other side or both sides, and it's cooler heads should prevail. It needs to stop. I mean, easier said than done. I get it. But somewhere along the line, it can't go on another year and a half or two like that. Somehow there needs to be a ceasefire, and these negotiations have to pile through here, and they have to be successful. Now, whether we're threatening enough to make them happen, I mean, I don't honestly believe both of these conflicts, the Ukraine-Russia thing, I don't see this guy and Putin ever, unless something crazy happens, ever sitting down and cutting a deal. I mean, Putin's not going to do it. He'll fight to the last man as long as it's not him. And this
guy, worse, Thomas, we're not going to do it either.
Well, but I'm saying somebody has got to knock both of their heads together and say, look, the sanctions we're putting on Russia, if you think those are hard, this is what's coming, and you're going to tell the guy at the Ukraine, this isn't a bad deal, you got to take it, or we're stopping sending you stuff. It needs to be somebody else. It's not going to be those two. And it sure as hell isn't going to be the head of Hamas and Netanyahu. Because Netanyahu, I don't think he thinks the minute the war's over, he's going to get tossed out or something. There's something weird about that guy. But by the same token, I don't want people from there attacking Jewish people and killing them like they did October 6th, taking hostages. But someplace, somewhere, somebody's going to have to say, enough. And they're getting enough support from other people that maybe the other people or the people have to say enough. I don't know, maybe the discussion should be between us and Iran. As horrible as that would be. But I mean, these things are calling for a Solomon, a Churchill, a somebody, and I don't see one. Do you?
No, we don't want those kind of people at the bargaining table either. If we had them, I don't think we'd want them. We've got, you know, unclean hands in all of these operations, Tom, and we've alienated so many people. People, you know, hurt us, you know. Pontificate about stuff and see us do something completely opposite and not be unable to make up our minds for any kind of clarity.
Well, Jamie, you know,
it's the strategy for any of this stuff.
But you can't.
We have no you know, persuasion anymore in any of this.
But you can't.
We own it. We created it, but we can't stop it now.
Well, I mean, but you can't self-flagellate over yesterday. You gotta figure out what you did wrong and go. I mean, I learned a lot of stuff from trading. You could make every trade as bad as you could. Your portfolio, you come in the morning and say, who the hell's portfolio is this? And then you go, oops, it's mine. But you got to shake it off. You got to shake it off and say, okay, how do I get this to where it looks reasonable? Go back in and make today a better day. You can't fix yesterday. We can't. I mean, as much as, you know, we ran the Indians off. You know, we had slavery here. It's over. We're never going to do it again, blah, 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 and we're going to make sure that nobody does it going forward. What else can we do, Jen?
Well, we can't fix what's broken if we don't think it's broken.
Right. Man. But I'm saying that, you know, the stuff that happened 300 years ago, you and I weren't here. All we can do is make sure there's a bazillion ills in the world to start on today without worrying about ones that are 100 years ago. I mean, for God's sake, the world's there's probably more people enslaved now than there ever were back then. I mean, I'm not saying how they managed to go through the Constitution allowing slavery, I have no idea. I mean, that's appalling.
People who are beefing about you know, slavery reparations that are buying products produced by the slave labor, they just don't want to think about that.
Right. Well, yeah, it's not. Well, you know, the last time I'm glad I kept my mouth shut because I'm not going to cause any trouble, but the idea that there must have been a crowd of 50 people, I'm going to say 45 of them African American, waiting to get into the Nike store in Michigan City, I'm going, really? Really? The stuff is made in China. You think those people have a good do going? You know, I don't know. It's not like I've never bought anything from Nike. I have, but if you really care about stuff like that, which I think most people do, I mean, you would be a little more. But then again, if you have a family and you're being crushed by these inflation things, I mean, I remember I've been shopping at Duluth Trading for a long time. I'm going to say 5 years ago, Jan, if you picked up the catalog, there would be a pair of blue jeans made, totally sourced and made in the U.S. Instead of being, you know, $50 or $40, it was $75. It's not in the catalog anymore. You know, so, okay, we can bitch about everything being in China, but if you've got five kids and you walk in and you don't care if it's made in China, you got to get blue jeans for the five kids, right?
Right.
And even though you may intellectually care, but money-wise, you don't. I mean,
Tom, I got a poll here a couple minutes early. Sorry about it, but
no problem.
I have to sign off, but I'll talk to you again on Monday.
All right, because yeah, and I can talk. We'll talk to Andrew about.
I'm just getting warmed up here. So.
Yeah, I know. Well, I mean, it's not like there's not. The weird part though, Jan, is it's all the same subject, isn't it?
Yeah.
Just depending on where you go at it. I mean, what are we going to do? How are we going to fix it? Do we have the money? Who's going to do it? I mean, it's simple. It's simple on that, but I'll certainly. We talk a little bit here. We got the VIX is down to 13.48 after this big run up in the market, and this is one of the amazing things about market volatility, implied volatility, which essentially is the price of insurance of the market. Okay, if you're going to protect your stocks or your index, whatever it is, what does it cost to pay? And one of the most interesting phenomenon of the market. Is that as the market goes up and the price is higher and maybe more likely to turn if it gets ahead of itself or not, you know, it could keep going, you would think that the price of insurance would stay even or maybe even go up, but it like never does. It's really crazy. In 2007, we'd been doing the protected index program for 10 years. Well, 2007, the market was up, up, up. This is during housings are going up, everything's great. Even though, if you looked at the mortgage crisis and stuff, things were already starting to break down around, but the market didn't know or didn't care. It kept going up. Well, I had some clients. We PTI, was the money manager of the year at, that was the name of the place. I'll think of it. The big rating agency. And the reason why is the price of the puts got down so low that we bought extras because they were so cheap. The VIX was like 9 or something. So when things went down, not only do we have some extra puts to protect, so instead of being, you know, 30, 40 deltas long, I won't go into that, we might have been break even but on the deltas, but then when it went down, we had extras, so the deltas went up on those, plus the volatility went up. We actually made money on the Morningstar. We actually made money on that. and you sit there and go, and then when the market really crapped out down, the volatility, so let's say a stock or an index went from, like the spiders. Spiders this morning are 515, they're down $1.85. Now, and the implied volatility in there is probably a 12 or a 13. Well, if something crazy were to happen and the market were to drop to, say, 400, you know, perish the thought, I guarantee you that the price of insurance, the VIX, the implied volatility, would be a lot higher. Now, you might say, now some of us might say, I don't need to insure it anywhere near as much at 400 as I did at 515. But that's not the way the market works. So it for people who don't want to hedge themselves a little bit after a market rally, you actually, crazy as it may seem, a lot of times you can get in on the relative cheap. You shouldn't be able to. I mean, 2 weeks ago when we were heading south, we had those couple of bad weeks, the VIX made it to 18. Well, now we've bounced all the way back in the market to where the prices are a lot higher and the cost of insurance is cheaper. Not telling anybody to do anything. I'm just saying it is a phenomenon where if somebody did want to do something in the way of protection, you can actually do it at an implied volatility cheaper than you could before, which is sort of bizarre. And so, you know, it's something to think about. I really would, after this run-up this year, in the first few months, I really would encourage everybody to take a look at their portfolio, look at it, see if it isn't what you would do today, find a way to fix it to what you would do today. The first exercise is sit down with the wife or whoever and say, if we had nothing, if we had just cash, what would we do? And if you say we'd like to do this, this is what we need to be invested, this is what we want this. If your portfolio matches that, God love you. I'm going to say not very many people do. And then you get to the questions, well, how can I sell a winner? How can I do this? How can I do that? If you need any help with that, on a day when things are normal, we can help you out with that. Or at least attempt to, if you want to talk to us. But when everything goes to hell, it's the wrong time to talk. A, people got no time. People can't help. So just, if it matches up, well, I trade it every day. Mine didn't match up any morning. So I know what it feels like to look at something and go, wait a minute, this isn't what I want to look at. It. So if you're in that spot, I mean, we're around. S&P futures down 19, NASDAQ futures down 105. We'll see if this keeps going this way. I doubt it since we've been pretty strong. But who knows? They don't ask me. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks is brought to you by PTI Securities and Futures. Go to ptisecurities.com. PTI Pro Direct. Trade for as low as a penny per share and a dollar per option contract. Learn more at ptiprodirect.com. Nadex. Offering an intuitive way to trade the financial markets. Visit nadex.com. Home Source Realty. Call Audrey Johnson at 708-349-3456. Hamzy Analytics. Listen to Fari Hamzy every other Thursday and visit hamzyanalytics.com. ChiroMed. Back or neck pain? Schedule a complimentary consultation by calling 708-403-2727. DAX Research. Tune in for David Andelman's technical analysis on Mondays and Thursdays and call 1-800-821-4968.
That's all, folks.